Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
When does adulthood really begin? U.S. law allows us to vote and serve in the military at 18, drink and serve alcohol at 21, and serve in Congress at 25. But in 2011, many young people reached those ages still turning to their parents to help with education expenses, day-to-day advice, even a place to live. Not only are those young people and their parents often perfectly okay with the arrangement, some experts say this social trend might actually be a positive one, at least for families that can afford it. Rick Sederston is professor of human development and family sciences at Oregon State University and a member of the MacArthur Research Network on Transitions to Adulthood. His new book is called Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. Rick, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
You write here that this is not so much a failure to launch as a preparation to launch. Why does it take so much longer today for teens and 20-somethings to achieve full independence?
Well, I mean, a major shift, and this is no surprise, relates to the economy. And it's not just the current recession, really. The current recession has kind of heightened a set of patterns that have been in the works for a few decades. Really, I mean, it just takes much longer to get or find jobs today that allow young people to live independently, let alone raise families on. And it also takes a whole lot more resources to get launched.
And, of course, the work world is just different now. People don't, you know, get a job with one company and expect to stay there until they retire. Can you talk about the difference between job hopping and what you call job shopping?
Sure. This is a great example of the rupture in the economy we were just talking about. I mean, job hopping is something that's often much more typical of young people who aren't well resourced. I mean, young people who especially don't have college degrees. They shift from one job to another, often looking for just a slightly better wage or a job that's a slightly better fit for them. I mean, these are young people who take jobs who will move from one job to another for as little as, say, 15 cents an hour. That's kind of job hopping. It's more focused on the immediate wage and the immediate fit. Job shopping is something we talk about as being, you know, much more typical among the privileged, or at least among those who have college degrees, where, you know, their eyes are set on the long term and on kind of making strategic, careful, upward moves through a profession. And in a way, it doesn't matter whether you're job hopping or you're job shopping. It's a kind of dress rehearsal for the rest of work life to come. I mean, none of us can really take a lifetime of security for granted anymore.
You know, these days, helicopter parenting has a really negative connotation. But kids with involved parents do reap some pretty important benefits.
They do. Our society is a kind of sink or swim society. I mean, how young people fare as they move through their 20s is really a function of what their families can do for them. And it's here that we see a great deal of inequity, of course, in our society. And this decade of life, moving through the 20s, really kind of crystallizes and even accentuates the kind of inequality that exists among kids going into adulthood. The support of parents makes a huge difference. It's probably the single most important determinant of how young people fare in our society. And in that sense, we're not advocating, helicopter parents per se, but we are advocating involved parenting. This is not a time in life where parents should step back. This is not a time in life where the school of hard knocks parenting, as we call it in the book, 18-year out, 21-year out, works well. In many ways, it can seriously backfire.
Is this a class-dependent phenomenon? Because it seems like a lot of parents might like to offer their kids extra time at home and extra resources, but they're trying to make a living themselves, and they simply can't afford to do that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Chris. It's also these are also not just other people's kids anymore. I mean, this has seriously hit the middle class, and the degree to which families are struggling economically today because of the recession has just accentuated that. But you know, the support downward from parents to kids in our society has been going on for a long while. I mean, even in the late 80s, about a third of the costs of raising a kid to 18 came again as kids move through the 20s. And that was the late 80s, a couple decades ago. Some of our new evidence is showing that that parents are kind of tithing now with their young kids. They're giving about 10%, their young adult kids, they're giving about 10% of their household incomes each year to their kids under 25. And the amazing thing about that is that it's true across the socioeconomic spectrum. It's not just true of the middle class and higher. It's true of working class parents and poor parents who've kind of caught on to the fact that for their kids to get ahead, they got to do more. Getting 10% of $300,000 a year is totally different than getting the 10% of $30,000 a year.
Yeah.
But the bigger point is that all parents in the U.S. today have caught on to the fact that parental support matters and matters in a big way.
Well, you know, what really surprises me about all this, it stands to reason that young people would appreciate the option to get a little extra help into what were once considered the adult years. It's remarkable to me that parents really don't seem to be complaining about this.
Yeah, Chris, that really relates to the fact that there's been a fundamental shift. I mean, besides the economy, which we talked about earlier, there's been a fundamental shift in the relationship between parents and kids. I mean, you know, new kinds of kids don't just come about out of the blue, right? I mean, they're produced by new kinds of parents. And I think many parents today have really, you know, striven to create a different kind of relationship with their kids than the one they knew with their own parents, a relationship that's much closer and more connected. So in a way, it's no surprise that, you know, things like living at home become new kinds of options, not just because the young person needs it, but because the parent likes it.
You're clear here also that in most cases, and this is backed by research, 20-somethings still living at home are not taking advantage of the situation.
Yeah, I mean, we're not finding that young adults are really kind of mooching off their parents. Again, I think support goes both ways. I mean, parents also get something out of the relationship with their kids. I mean, it may not be money at this point in life, though, you know, maybe there will be some payoff in having built stronger relationships with their kids later in their lives. But, you know, I think the kind of emotional satisfaction, the kind of satisfaction people have in their relationships with these kids today, you know, also goes a long way. Young people aren't mooching. I think they're realizing the value also in getting their ducks in a row and not launching too soon.
What's the difference between kids still living at home, young people living at home with their parents and maybe contributing to the household finances, and what happened, I think, more when I was this age, which is that you moved out, but if you really needed help, you could call mom and dad?
Yeah. Well, again, I think that's true. I mean, I think in the last couple decades, the kind of parental home has often been a place to which you could return. I mean, I think that what's happened with the recession now and with the fact that we have seen a real surge in staying at home longer and moving home later is that, you know, people can point to something out there, outside of them, that says, hey, what's happening to me is because the economy really stinks, right? And so it kind of releases people from a kind of stigma that they might otherwise have felt. But, you know, young people are also not thinking about this as a place they're going to stay for the long haul. It's still the same mentality. It's a place to kind of, you know, hold tight, sort things out, make careful strategic decisions about what you want and need in your future, and then to go when you're ready. And, you know, from our vantage point, the evidence shows that's not a bad thing.
So we're not in a danger of 50-year-olds hoping their 80-year-old mother will still be doing their laundry.
I don't think so. I think what happens really when you see the co-residence of older children with parents is that it often has more to do with the parent than the kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a danger, again, I think, in focusing too much on the kid as if it's all driven by the kind of kid's emotional place. It's not really about that.
What about, you know, you point out here that it makes perfect sense that we know that people are delaying marriage later than they used to. They're having kids a little bit later than they used to. How does that affect the reality that at some point they're going to have to turn around and be called upon to help their parents?
Yeah, I think this is something we really don't know, whether the new kinds of investments that parents have made in their children will pay off for them later in life. I mean, we are a society in which, care for the old has largely been I mean, it's partially handled by the family unit, but partially handled by other institutions. And we just don't know how that's gonna play out. So I'm not really exactly sure how to answer that, except to say that the longer support of young adults clearly creates strain on families, especially on the generation in the middle who may themselves be caring for their older parents. And you know, that's sort of one fallout of a longer course to adulthood for kids, is that it can create more press on parents at a critical time in their life.
Are young people who don't have the option to extend their adolescent years going to be at a decided disadvantage?
Yeah, especially if it means that they bypass education. Uh-huh. I mean, in a way, we should be much more worried about kids who go too fast. I mean, a quick marriage is much more likely to result in divorce than involve kids. Quick parenting makes it much harder to attain education or work full-time and build skill that's going to carry you for the long haul. A quick departure from home before you're ready, that leaves fewer resources for getting through the month, let alone investing in your future. There, the evidence is super clear. I mean, living at home today keeps a whole lot of young people out of poverty. And again, the reality is that if you bypass education, it's much harder to go back later when you've got other responsibilities, and especially when you're working a full-time or parenting. In a way, regardless of where you fall on the political spectrum, you should care about all these things. Doing them right matters way more than doing them fast.
How delineated are the rules when, let's say, a young person graduates from college and goes back to live with mom and dad for a while? Do most families set up sort of a structure for how this will play itself out?
Yeah, Chris, this is a great question. I think this is the really murky area, right? You go to Borders, you look at all the parenting titles, you see hundreds upon hundreds of titles about how to raise your little kid, but not a whole lot when it comes to how to raise your grown.
How do you raise your 26-year-old? Yeah.
This is kind of where the guidebooks end. But I guess what I would say is, you know, much as is true when you're raising little kids, what works for one doesn't work for another. Mm-hmm. And so much of the expectations and arrangements that parents and young adult kids have to make has to kind of be tailored to the young adult. There are no hard and fast rules in that sense. I do think there are some critical things, like it's a really important moment to open conversation about alcohol, drugs, dating, sexual health, and money, especially money. So many young people today have no clue about how to manage finances. That's a critical area. And I think if parents have expectations about, you know, the support they're providing and whether any of it should be paid back, those should be made clear. If they have expectations about what young people should contribute to the household, those things should be made clear. We are not in any way arguing that young people shouldn't have responsibility. That's important for young people to move forward.
Well, it's interesting about the finance question, because while children are children, many, many adults sort of shy away from discussing really candidly what the family's financial situation is.
That's absolutely true. It seems especially true today. I think it's a reason that many young people spiral downward when they do move out, if they haven't been prepared for how to manage money and how to just plot and plan and develop goals that are also realistic for the resources they have and the capacities they have.
Rick Sederston is my guest. He's professor of human development and family sciences at Oregon State University and a member of the MacArthur Research Network on Transitions to Adulthood. His new book is called Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. It's written with Barbara E. Ray.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Human Development and Family Sciences at Oregon State University, Rick Setterston. He's also a member of the MacArthur Research Network on Transitions to Adulthood. His new book is called Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. I'm curious about this, Rick. The old parental saw is, while you're under my roof, you will follow my rules. And I'm wondering if young people are less inclined to rebel against their parents' values and their beliefs if they're still accepting assistance from them.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that one of the things that actually permits some of the closeness and connectedness that parents and kids have today is that they're actually more aligned in their values than prior generations have been. I think that it actually gives them more common ground for actually talking in productive ways about the things they want and need. One of the really critical things is that there is a kind of openness and a kind of mutuality in the kinds of communication they're having.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll hit the phones now, first with Maggie in Fort Worth. Hello, Maggie.
Hello. I'm comparing notes from my college years as you speak, and I'm realizing that now that my children are in college and getting ready to look at graduate school or work, my parenting technique seems to bounce off of what I felt my parents did wrong. And when my daughter was about 9, I told her that I kind of had a list of things that I felt that my parents did that I didn't like, so I wasn't going to do it to them. And my daughter asked if she could see that list.
Interesting.
I haven't
How did
written
it, go?
It down. But she understood it was virtual. But at this point in time, I don't try to hold them too close. I know they may come back, and I'm afraid if I said, you can come back, you should come back, or whatever, they would stay away. Hmm. And I want to leave that avenue open for them to choose.
Wait, Rick, is that a dilemma that you see a lot?
Yeah, was it Maggie?
Yeah,
she's gone it right. I mean, I think what's really critical today is that the parents be present. Step back if you're doing too much in the way Maggie's trying to monitor her own approach. Kind of be present, be there, be connected, but don't overdo it. And I think, step up if you're not doing enough. Give more advice, guide. I think it's a fine line. It's funny. I was thinking on my drive today. Maybe something what we're talking about is something we could call Goldilocks parenting. I don't know whether somebody's come up with that term already.
Too hot, too soft.
But really, we don't need parenting that's too big, mm-hmm. and you don't need parenting that's too small. It needs to be just right. And what Maggie is talking about is exactly that. And there's a real tension for parents because these are critical years. A slip-up is not an easy thing to recover from today. It's a major difference between today and decades past. Parents are worried about how their kids are going to do, and rightly so.
So, Rick, without the traditional milestones of graduation from high school or certainly college as indicators that the era of independence has begun for a particular individual, how do young people know when they're ready to go?
Yeah, so from a subjective standpoint, this is really different. I mean, in a way, we're kind of trapped in the middle of the last century when we think about when we think about the benchmarks that we use to evaluate young people today. The post-World War II years in particular created a kind of quick start to adulthood, a kind of lockstep life that's simply not true for any of us anymore, even those of us who are well outside of the early adulthood period. I mean, that quick start, lockstep life is not something any of us can take for granted. And when we apply benchmarks to young people that emerged at a time when economic opportunities were ample and when social conventions really reinforced the need to go fast, we don't really do right by young people. But then you're left with the question, well, what are the benchmarks, right, which is what you're asking. And I think most people just want to see some signs of progress. It's not that these things don't matter to young people anymore. I mean, they're trying to do many of them, whether it's leaving home or finishing school or finding work or getting married or having kids. They're just getting to some of them late, and they're getting to them in a more scrambled way. That doesn't mean they're unimportant.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next on the phones to L'Oreal in Duncanville. Hi, L'Oreal.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi.
My question kind of piggybacks off the previous caller. I have an 18-year-old son, and growing up, there was a lot of things once I reached that certain milestone, which is like graduating high school, because of socioeconomic things, my family was not able to give me that support. So I had to learn early on how to be independent and just do a lot of things with a young son in tow. So now that my son is about to graduate high school, I want to be able to give him more assistance than, you know, I was given. But at the same time, I have clear expectations of him and what I expect of him and what I would like, you know, where I would like for him to be. The problem is he is so resistant to my assistance. You know what I mean? Any kind of guidance I want to give him, it's like, I can do it myself, let me do it myself, but, you know, as a parent, I see he's not capable. So I try to step back somewhat, but it's like you were saying, I don't want it to backfire, where I'm so frustrated that I step back completely and say, do it yourself then, and then it backfires. And, you know, I don't want that high school graduation to be the final thing where, okay, you're 18, you didn't want to do what I asked you to do, you didn't want to take my assistance, now get out.
Yeah, that's a tough place to be. What do you think about that, Rick?
Yeah, you know, I think the other thing parents can think about when they're in that kind of bind is, you know, are there other people in their social network who might be able to help in more productive ways when parents really aren't able to have healthy or helpful conversations with their young adult? You know, whether it's another member of the family that they might, you know, have a more productive conversation with, if it's a counselor or a teacher, finding another adult that the young person can kind of have confidence in and get guidance from, that can go a long way as a kind of way to compensate for the volatile even relationship between a parent and a kid.
And you write in the book that, you know, even though a lot of young people are putting off marriage, their peer group often has a sort of familial role in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's no surprise, right? So in a way, when you're delaying marriage and you're delaying parenting, what happens is that, you know, the 20s now get filled up by friends who become family-like. This is not a brand new phenomenon, of course, but I think the irony today is that despite all the talk about how long people are living at home or the fact that they're coming back, young people today are actually living independently for longer, and they're filling it up with friends, and they're filling it up with intimate relationships they may be exploring. But, you know, starting in the 50s, the lockstep life was you left home, but you also married immediately, right? Or shortly thereafter. Today, there's a much longer period where you're living without a spouse. In some ways, that's the more interesting thing about today.
You know, it's interesting. I think about my kids are still pretty young, so I think if they were living at home with me, I can only still imagine having to remind them to shower and brush their teeth and all that. But I do think it would be a hard thing for parents, even if there's been that separation of 4 or 6 years of college in between, to transition to a role where you look at your children as adults who still need some help but are also capable of making many of their own decisions.
Yeah, you're right, Chris. You know, I think the interesting thing for me on that front is that in countries where parents and kids have kind of co-resided for a long time, there isn't the kind of stigma about living at home, and they seem to have figured it out. So I think, you know, a part of it may be that we're just in the middle of a transition in a way, and again, the recession has heightened the need for young people and parents to live together, parents and their own parents to live together. I mean, multi-generational living is becoming more common, especially in the face of the recession, and it means there are, again, no rules for how that looks or feels, but people will figure it out in time. I think the main thing is that you also can't treat the kid like a kid.
Right.
In a way, you probably have to treat the adult child more like the adult part than the child part.
We have an email here from Judy in Irving who writes, "My younger daughter railed against my tyranny from the age of 12 on and constantly vowed to assert her independence as soon as possible. So it was very gratifying when at the age of 21, she phoned me from college in another state to ask for advice. She said, now that I'm an on-paper adult, things are very different." And Judy says, "That was great."
It is great. I think this is the thing that often happens. I mean, the older, quote, children get, the more they also begin to really appreciate the investments and the guidance and the help that the parents have provided all along. And, you know, nothing promotes that more like when you have your own child. I think it creates a kind of reflectiveness on your own experience with parents, not just, as Maggie said, the things you might like to do differently, but also just how hard the task of parenting is. And I think most young people end up with a lot of appreciation some years out. So parents can hold on to that, too.
So the subtext of this book, I mean, we're talking about young people here. The truth is this has also changed the reality of what it means to be a parent in our times. And so many adults now really define their lives according to their time as parents. I'm wondering how empty nesters are affected when their children finally do head out on their own. Is it harder?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a new quality today because of it. I think it can become a kind of heavier experience in a way. I mean, both joyous in seeing children thrive, but also harder in a way in seeing them go. You're absolutely right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mary in Garland. Hi, Mary.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thanks.
So kind of following along with some of the previous calls, in my family, I experienced some of this when my nieces and nephews one by one came to live with me as they approached adulthood for some period. And I felt like that it was very important for them to be in a different situation in order to go through the process of growing up, that they just couldn't finish it at home. And then they were able to launch from there. And I'm wondering, what can you tell me about that process of going from being somewhat of a dependent child to a person who's ready to go out? I mean, how long does it usually take? What are they doing in their heads while they're sleeping on the couch?
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, I don't know how couchy they were. But, you know, we're really finding that most young people are really treading hard to kind of find a place to lock into the world. I think if they can take refuge in a house like yours and in a relationship like yours, that's a good thing. I think it's a different pace for every child in a way, and it really depends on what they're experiencing along the way that signals to them that they're changing. One of the other callers mentioned, on paper at 18 being an adult, or 21 being an adult because of some of the changing roles and responsibilities that come in the law, right? But I think for most people, this kind of process of this identity, becoming an adult, is one that is gradual and really emerges out of experiences we have along the way. We don't feel adult and then suddenly, do adult things. We do adult things and gradually begin to feel adult. Often it's not until people are parents or at least married that they will say they suddenly fully feel like adults. And it's usually parenting, actually. It's the thing that puts people kind of into this new kind of place in their identity, because they're suddenly responsible for another life.
Yeah, and it makes sense. Your childhood is officially over when you're responsible for someone else's childhood.
Exactly.
What about, is there any danger, Rick, to the reality that let's talk about middle-class families here. Mom and Dad's home is probably much nicer than the first apartment you're going to get. Is that a draw, or is that something that parents need not worry about?
Well, yeah, there is some evidence that shows that young people's expectations about what you need to move out and to get launched, that their expectations have grown.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that economically it also does take more today to live on your own. And the reality is that those who jump quickly are exactly the ones who spiral downward in debt. We're finding really that the people who suffer most are the ones who aren't making a strong enough investment in their future. And a college degree is really central to that. So if it means that if getting a degree means that a young person makes a choice to stay at home and pursue a degree locally, that's still a great thing. A degree is what's going to matter.
Do we have enough options in this country for people who might not want to go to, say, a four-year university but still want more education than high school?
No, we don't, and it's a real call for alarm in this book. I mean, the good news is that a college degree still pays. There, the evidence is clear. But it only pays if you finish, right?
Yeah.
and it only pays if you take out debt that's in line with your potential earnings.
Mm-hmm.
I think those two points are really critical points. For example, it's shocking to most people today to know that only 40% of those who start four-year institutions will finish within 6 years. And that's deemed to be a point of no return. I mean, if you're not finished with a four-year degree in 6 years, it's unlikely that you will ever finish. And it's a sign that many young people are stepping up to college. They're swinging hard, but they're striking out. And the problem is there are very few places for them to go when they fail. Community colleges are a major place for us to invest in that sense because they serve a much broader range of people. And actually, it's far more typical to go from a four-year institution into a community college than it is to start in a community college and eventually jump to a four-year. We've done a lot to increase access to college in this country, but a lot of young people get there and they're sorely unprepared, and they're striking out big time.
Well, I would think one of the advantages of community colleges is that there is not necessarily you're not taking on typically a huge amount of debt in order to get at least that 2 years of education.
Right, that's right. I mean, the cost is much lower. But again, you're serving a much broader spectrum of people than you are in a four-year institution. But many of the things we're thinking about as kind of next steps for policy are things that are really meant to give young people who aren't college-bound or don't want to be college-bound other places to kind of hook into productive roles. It's a real problem.
Rick Setterston is my guest. He's professor of human development and family sciences at Oregon State University and a member of the MacArthur Research Network on Transitions to Adulthood. His new book, written along with Barbara E. Ray, is called Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Oregon State University Professor of Human Development and Family Sciences, Rick Setterston. His new book is Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. Let's go next to Angela in Arlington. Hi, Angela.
Hi. Okay, so my question, comment was a lot of my friends in about the same age about their parents are actually pretty close to them in age, and I was wondering if maybe that doesn't play a part in them letting the kids stay home a little bit longer because they kind of got forced out into the real world a lot younger than what they probably wanted for their kids. And if that doesn't help in the abiding by the rules at home, because I mean it's a lot easier to have the same moral code with your kids when they're so much closer to you and me.
What do you think, Rick? Less of a generation gap?
Yeah, I had a hard time hearing her, but I think the question was about the closeness in age.
Yeah.
Yeah, so actually, I mean, the evidence clearly, kind of runs counter to that. I mean, if you look historically, later and later fertility means that the age difference between parents and kids has actually gotten much bigger. The irony is that their values are much more closely aligned. So it's not the age difference per se, but it is something about the alignment of values between parents and kids and their attitudes that kind of makes this a more fruitful, close relationship. We don't see what the caller is asking about.
Is this phenomenon having an impact on parents' ability to save for their own retirement?
Well, it is. So, just as before, I think we talked about, a longer transition into adult life for kids and the need of parents in our society to support to provide support downward to kids creates a kind of press at midlife. Mm-hmm. I mean, that already exists, especially if parents have parents of their own who are in old age. I think it may have repercussions, real ones, for the kinds of options parents then have for their own retirement, for example. We haven't been watching this long enough to really know how all that will play out, but it is a very real possibility.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Calvin in Denton. Hi, Calvin.
Hi. I have a question / comment regarding your guest. I'm 24, but I was living at home until I was 22, and I currently go to college and I'm about to graduate this semester. But my question really is, how does the author feel about this generation, since we are staying at home a lot longer? How does he feel about as far as in our ability to get things done, as far as in taking over for the next generation that will eventually be leaving the workforce in the next couple of years? Because a lot of us of this generation, our parents gave us a lot of things or wanted to provide us more with what they didn't have. For example, my father did that, and I feel that like I don't have a certain drive to push myself. But at the same time, it was nice of them to let me stay at home so that way I could kind of find myself and kind of find out where I wanted to go. I just wanted to see what your author had to say about that.
So let me make sure I understand, Calvin. You feel like you don't have to, you haven't felt like you had to support yourself. It was about choosing to do certain things.
Yeah, but also I noticed like my father, he grew up and he didn't really have a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So when I was coming of age, I didn't have, but he moved out really early. I didn't move out so early, and I stayed around, but I was going to school. But I also noticed that because a lot of people our age were kind of given a car, or they didn't, they never had to work for things, but yeah, they were kind of more assisted. How does that translate to later on in life?
What do you think, Rick?
Yeah, I guess there are a couple things in what he said that are important to highlight. I mean, one is that you were in school while you were living at home, and I think this is a really critical thing. Living at home can be a really great economic decision today if the young adult is pursuing education, or if they're in a no-pay or a low-pay apprenticeship, let's say, that will give them real skills and edge on the job market later, if it means they're able to save up so that they have a stronger launch when they do go. I mean, we don't really see this kind of prolonged independence over the long haul, or sorry, dependence over the long haul. But I do think there are also things about parents and kids today that, you know, again, that change the relationship and ultimately do affect the kid. I mean, he mentions his dad kind of grew up in hardship in a way, didn't have much, left early, and then probably came to know affluence as a function of the time in which he grew older. It's much different than, say, having known affluence and now in the middle of this recession suddenly knowing hardship. I think many young people will have to get acquainted with hardship. the world around us is changing, but you know, he's raising a great question about whether the kind of mentalities of young people have also shifted in having been given perhaps too much.
And what do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think that's something we do worry a little bit about when it comes to the middle class and higher. But you know, there are so many young people who have so little. I guess that's where I've got my eyes. They're not young people like the caller. They're really young people who don't have the support of parents, whose families don't have resources, who are really struggling to find their way. This caller definitely has had that to fall back on, the support of parents. And I think we're really concerned about, you know, the group we call treaders in this book. I mean, who could easily sink if we're not really watching them carefully? Hmm. This is a big group of young people whose futures are pretty precarious, and we're really worried about them. Again, that caller did have the strong support of parents, it's clear, to fall back on, and there are many young people who don't have that. I just think it's important that we keep our eyes on them.
You know, what's interesting is you say they could easily sink. It sounds like they could just as easily rise if they had a hand.
That's exactly right. And I think so much of this important action to target is around education. You know, it's we we talk in this country about college for all. We have this mantra, and young people today have heard that all their lives, college is the way. But, you know, we got some serious alarms going off in the realm of education. I mentioned before just the a great proportion of young people who are dropping out of college. But even stepping back, high school dropout rates are also abysmal in this country, and we can't improve the futures of young people today without getting a serious grasp both on what's going on in high schools and even earlier, and then what's going on in universities.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Lisa in Rowlett. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a son who is 21. He lives with us. He attends college. He had a golf scholarship at a small school, but we made him come home after the first year because it was playtime. Anyway, it seems like he's going to college just because that's what he's supposed to do. I would say every semester he fails one class. He doesn't seem to have a clue what he wants to do. I was wondering how much of a role, if any, do you think that the lack of an end goal has to do with him not seeming to have any drive? And do you have any recommendations for us?
Well, it's hard to say specifically without knowing more about him. But I think he does reflect that kind of group of treaders we're talking about. You know, he may not have been the kind of kid who would have gone to college in an earlier era. Let's say, I mean, he's not sure where it's all going or what he wants to do. You know, we see this often. I mean, young people are moving through multiple majors or even switching institutions, going between a four-year and a community college just to find their way. Often these are first-generation college students who, you know, they might have supportive parents, but the parents don't have the know-how about how to navigate college. And so, you know, I think he's not unusual. That doesn't bring comfort, I guess. But, you know, in contrast to the kinds of kids who are doing super well, I mean, these are kids who not only have the strong support of parents, which you're clearly providing, but these are kids who have a good sense of their future. They're making really strategic decisions that are a good match to their skills and abilities, and they know how to get from here to there. And it sounds like that may be what's missing for him, a clear sense of what the end goal is, as you said. And in thinking about even a range of possible end goals, like trying to work backward to think about how you'd get there from where you now are, what would it take? And I guess equipping kids with real knowledge, frank knowledge about what kind of end goals are really possible for them, given who they are, and what kinds of things really do need to happen along the way if they're going to get there.
So the old prescription about teach a kid the value of a college education by making him or her pay for it, or you know, teach them the value of hard work by making them support themselves, it always sounded so good. It sounds like it doesn't actually work that way because what they learn is that work is really hard, and sometimes they still can't support themselves.
Yeah, and you know, I guess I also don't want us to mistakenly assume that all parents provide college education for their kids. I mean, many families clearly can't, and these are really, really hard choices for young people today that are heavily conditioned by what parents can do. But you know, again, we're seeing so much alarm in part in this education realm because so many young people are stepping up to try, but they are failing. And the nation that is failing miserably in education will never be a truly great nation. It can't hold on to that when so many young people are failing or floundering.
Let's go back to the phones now. We'll speak with Peter in Benbrook. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thanks.
I graduated high school in 1993. And at that point, I was going off to college, although I was going to college in the same town. And my mom was concerned about what would happen. And so I think she found it somewhere. I'm not sure. But she made me sign a Declaration of Independence. Essentially, what happened was, I think it was more about her than it was about me. Because it was essentially a document saying, I will be here if you need me, my mom talking. Mm-hmm. But here are the things that are expected of you, and you have to make the decision. I'm not going to come calling you. I'm not going to show up unexpectedly. You're going to have to figure this out, but I'll be here if you need me. And I was wondering have you heard of such a thing? Where did such an idea come from? Is that anything that anybody's doing now?
At what age did she do that?
I was 18. It was when I just graduated high school and getting packing up to move into a dorm room.
Well, what she did put into action was what I was saying before about making expectations clear. I haven't heard of cases like that. I mean, I have heard about of many, many, many cases, especially when young adults are living at home. Parents making it clear what they are and aren't expected to do as members of the household and of the family. But 18's early to do it, and again, it's a dangerous time to do it today. Anyway, what matters again? The evidence there is clear that that a jump that happens too soon, especially in today's economy, can really spiral downward in terms of the debt young people carry and the ways in which leaving too soon or establishing your independence too soon can actually knife off some of your future opportunities.
So can you offer any advice to families who would love to be able to provide this, but for whom it's a financial impossibility right now?
I think families, of course, need to do what they can do. And, one of your callers earlier really talked about her struggle with her young adult. I think it is important, I guess, for parents to know that in our society, which is a sink or swim society, I mean, after the age of 18 or 21, I mean, most supports are cut off. It really does rest on what families can provide. And the evidence, again, is clear. Parents who provide, especially, in the early part of the 20s and in doing everything they can to facilitate a college degree in particular, is what pays off over the long haul. When kids bypass education, their opportunities are numbered in today's world.
So as parents, we should simply, I guess we need to adjust our thinking about the term during which we'll be parents. You don't think it goes to the end of high school. You think it goes to the end of college.
Yeah, it does. And maybe even longer. The question is whether parents are actually prepared to do that. And of course, every family is different. And again, we are not in any way saying that a slower course is a slacker course, but we're saying a slower course allows young people to make strategic, careful choices that help them build skill and experience that will carry them for the long haul. And that's true regardless of whether you're talking about, partnerships and marriages. It's true whether you're talking about education, or it's true whether you're talking about work. I mean, these are things that today will have making careful strategic choices in those areas
counts
will carry you
time.
In a much more positive way for the long haul.
Rick Sederston's new book is called Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. Rick, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.